Somewhere.
The Economic Development and Housing Budget Division for Monday, April 6th, 2009, will come to order. Senator Rest, welcome to the committee, Senate File 1610.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1610 allows the Metropolitan Council...
Senator Rest, can you kind of move the mic closer to you, please? Thank you.
Senate File 1610 allows the Met Council to access some excess funds, funds that are not being used currently, in the Livable Communities Fund and the Rolfe Funds, the Right-of-Way Loan Funds, for the next couple of years to use for transit operating deficits. The bill has been heard in the Transportation Committee, but Mr. Bell is here to explain the plight that the Metro Transit finds itself in and how these funds are temporarily for 2009, 10, and 11 will be, we hope, approved for use for making up some of the transit deficit.
Mr. Bell.
And if you'd allow him to give his testimony.
Please say your name for the record.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Bell. I am chair of the Metropolitan Council. As Senator Rest stated a moment ago, I am here to speak in favor of Senate File 1610, provide you an overview of that, and then entertain any questions you may have. I believe, Mr. Chair, that all the committee members have my materials in front of them that they can follow along if they so choose. The intent of Senate File 1610 is to minimize the adverse effects of Metro Transit's budgetary situation, primarily resulting from the shortfall in our MVEST revenues. And this comes at a time when our ridership is at a 27-year high. In calendar year 08, we provided over 82 million rides. And it also preserves the opening of the North Star corridor as well as the UPA corridors on 35W and Cedar Avenue. The Federal Transit Administration takes a dim view of cuts in one part of your transit system while you are adding components in another part of your transit system. Senate File 1610, Mr. Chair, would allow the Council to use in calendar year 2009 through 2011 up to 75% of the livable community account revenues. We have three accounts in our livable communities program: our demonstration account, our TIBRA account, and our affordable housing account. Senate File 1610 would also allow the Council to use the RALF revenues, but maintain the program balance. So from the RALF fund, we would use the revenues, our levy, from the RALF fund, but we would not take any money out of the balance that we currently have in that fund. This authority that we are requesting, Mr. Chair, would also expire in 2010. A bit of historical information on the Livable Communities program. As I indicated, there are three subcomponents to this. There's the Livable Communities Demonstration Account, and since 1996, we have provided over $87 million in grants to 51 communities. And our Tax-Based Revitalization Account, Mr. Chair, which cleans up polluted lands, we have provided over $77 million in grants to 38 communities. In our local housing incentive accounts, we have provided nearly $20 million to 57 communities. And, Mr. Chair, that last program, the local housing incentives account, we do in conjunction with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Twin City Family Housing Fund. The right-of-way acquisition revolving loan fund, also known as the RAL fund, the council lends money to cities to purchase future trunk highway right-of-way. So a municipality where we've got a, where there's a trunk highway, and we're going to, let's say, expand that, and we need to acquire the right-of-way, we provide dollars to the municipality to purchase that right-of-way and nail that down at today's price. And then when that improvement actually goes in, we are repaid by the municipality for that work. Over the past 25 years, these funds have been used to purchase right-of-way on 494, 212, Trunk Highway 169, and 610, just as examples of how those dollars are used. The Metropolitan Council's annual property tax levy for these various accounts, for the Livable Communities Demonstration Account, we levy about $8.2 million on an annual basis. For the RALF Fund, it's about $3.5 million. And for the Local Housing Incentives Account, how we fund that is a $1 million transfer from our general levy. So the Met Council does a general levy in addition, and then we transfer a half a million dollars from the demonstration account. That's how we get the $1.5 million. For the TIBRA account, also known as the tax-based revitalization, that comes out of fiscal disparity. So we do not do a levy for that, but that actually comes out of our fiscal disparities. The utilization of the program, and really the core reason, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that we are requesting this permission is that of late, because of the downturn of the economy, and the lack of development both region-wide, statewide, and nationwide, these accounts have not been subscribed to as they have in the past. And so we thought it was prudent, rather than to build up our reserves and these, or build up this fund, that we would use it to address our transit deficit for a short period of time, blink it off, for, if you will, and then blink it back on. To illustrate that point, between 2003 and 2006, TIBRA had applications seeking funds for $2 for every $1 we had available. In 2008, it was a one-to-one ratio, just about half the requests we had. Before 2006, in the Livable Communities Demonstration Account, the ratios were $5 to $6 for every $1 available, and that has been reduced dramatically to $2 in requests for every $1 available. That's just a reflection in the downturn of the economy, the lack of demand for these funds. In 2002, there were 73 applications. In 2008, there were 20 applications, a further illustration of the point. The utilization of the program. Six TIBRA grantees requested $2.3 million in previously awarded grants in 2000 million. In other words, they returned $2.3 million in grants that we had awarded. The LCDA account, they returned $930,000. So sometimes we give a grant, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is not used, and then the money comes back to us. And to illustrate that point, it was 2.3 in the TIBRA account, the tax-based revitalization, cleaning up polluted land, and in our livable community demonstration account, it was almost $1 million of dollars that had come back. These relinquished funds, along with the unawarded $900,000, leave a balance of $4 million in our livable communities account. And while we think that that's good to have a balance, it is hard to reconcile $4 million in unused funds and a transit deficit, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, of $62.5 million for the biennium of 10 and 11. The current RALF balance is $4.3 million, and we do not plan on using the balance. I want to be clear. The RALF fund, we are not going to use the balance, just the levy. With the livable communities account, we are going to use the balance and the levy. So that's an important distinction. The current RALF balance is $4.3 million, with Trunk Highway 610 set to receive funds. We expect a repayment of nearly $2 million for that. So they will get some stimulus dollars, hopefully, for 610, and then the balance will grow from $4.3 million to $6.3 million. Maintaining the current RALF balance and repayment from 610 will offset any immediate loss to the program. In other words, we can still run the RALF program with the $6 million balance through 2011. Current projects, as indicated, will not be affected. And in sum, Mr. Chair, right now, as I mentioned, the council faces in our region-wide transit efforts a deficit of $62.4 million. These are the proposed uses of the levy. $21 million to $29 million. LCDA would be $12 million. At 75% and a little over $2 million at 50%. TIBRA would be $7.5 million. If we use the full 75%, $5 million at 50%. RALF would be at a little over $5 million at 75% and $3.5 at 50%. And then we would transfer the balance that I mentioned earlier from the livable communities account for $4 million. The next strategy we would use, Mr. Chair, is $14 million from stimulus dollars. And then we would also extract $5 million from administrative efficiencies, draw down to $3 million for reserves. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would also, it's important to note that we are using a little over $7 million, about $7.5 million in reserves to deal with the transit shortfall in fiscal year 09. So this current fiscal year, we're drawing down over $7 million in reserves. We would plan to use an additional $3 million of reserves in fiscal year 10 and 11. MVEST reductions to the suburban transit providers, formerly known as the opt-outs, would be at $7 million. We are considering fare increases of $6 million. And when you add that up, that would deal with our $62.4 million shortfall. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll entertain any questions you may have.
Any questions, Senator Metzen?
Yeah. Other than, first, my first impression is I don't like what's going on here. I mean, we have an investment account that's used to pick up polluted property and right-of-ways, and the success has been extremely good. And how can a fund for investments, it's hard for me to imagine how you could take an investment account and use it for operating. I mean, aren't there any other funds available for operating? I mean, I know where I come from. They've used this for a lot of polluted land, really railroad properties and other just contaminated property that's not good for anything, because obviously 72 years ago we could do anything we wanted to with the land. And it's been used very successfully. And to take it out of one fund that deals with livable communities and puts it into an operation fund, I just can't put my arms around it. And then how about the projects that are probably in the works now in the pipeline? What's going to happen to those? And so I don't know. I guess I'm not convinced yet, but gosh, I would think, Mr. Beller, I know things are really tight around here, but to take money from something that's working pretty well and to do this, I just, it's hard to love it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, a couple of points I would make that I think are very, very important. One, in the RALF fund, we are not going to take the balance that currently exists in that account, which is $4.3 million. We are going to add $2 million if in fact we go ahead with 610, that that will leave a $6 million balance in that account. And I am convinced that any needs that come about between now and 2011, we will be able to handle with that $6 million. And the reason why we propose it that way is to address the very legitimate concern you're raising. It's a very successful program. Municipalities use it and like it. But we think that the cushion that we will have will allow for that. In addition, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen, DEED has $8 million for a cleaning up of polluted lands, which was a part of your question, and there's going to be $100 million in stimulus dollars for this purpose as well. Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen, I also think it's very important to note we at the Met Council have been told, and I think appropriately so, we have to work to solve our own problem. We have a $62.4 million deficit, a transit ridership that's at a 27-year high, 82 million rides, and I feel a strong commitment to build upon the successes of the transit system of recent years and expand that with North Star and Cedar Avenue Busway, the 35W Busway in Central not too long. And if we have to cut our transit service, it puts those very exciting new projects in jeopardy.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. But first I wanted to point out to the committee that if we accept the general fund cut that's been established by our targets, that would add another $13 million or so cut to Metro Transit operations, bringing our deficit to $75 million out of a roughly $350 million biennial budget. That's about 25%. And I don't know if it'd be fair to say or not, but it feels like, you know, given the fact that there are a number of fixed costs in the system, that means that the kind of service reductions that we would have to contemplate, the, you know, cutting the variable costs, if we were to accept that entire cut, $75 million, we weren't able to solve this problem either through the approach that's outlined in this bill or some other approach. We would have a transit system that would be virtually unusable. Now, there has been a proposal to solve this problem, you know, significantly, that also solves our structural dilemma, our year-to-year dilemma. But we're told that those resources are going to be absorbed by the tax committee's target and are not available to this purpose. So I agree with Senator Metzen. I really, really dislike this proposal, but I'm looking for help here because the governor has told the agency they have to go solve this collapse in the MVEST by themselves. Governor, to his credit, didn't give a general fund cut. And we haven't seen a lot coming out of the larger Senate budget. So we've got a problem here to solve. That's a kind of a message to the committee and a message to other people out here who care about our communities. We've got a big problem to solve. My question is, in the fare increase that's contemplated here on this last page, how much would that be the additional 25 cents, or is that an additional 50 cents that would kick in 2010?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that's a 25-cent increase, and it approximately for every dollar you increase fares, you collect about 70 cents because you do experience a reduction in ridership that accompanies that. That usually builds back up, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, in a 6 to 9 month period of time. However, it is important to add one of the last things I would like to do is, you well are aware, we just increased fares in October. A third of our transit population is transit dependent, and I think it goes without saying we tend to provide services to the lower end of the economic spectrum, and so increasing fares again in 2010 is something that I would like to avoid.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I would echo Senator Dibble's first comment, and that is that none of us, including Senator Dibble and myself, who are authors on this bill, think that this is a great proposal. However, what it does is allow us to continue to keep transit viable in the metropolitan area, and it does not impose an undue burden on the other funds that are being accessed to get us through this period of economic collapse. If we were not in a period of economic collapse, would we be making these kinds of suggestions? Absolutely not. However, that is not what we are faced with, and we know that we have uncomfortable and painful decisions to make about trying to cobble together programs that will allow things that we want to be ongoing to actually survive. So there are protections, as Mr. Bell indicated, on the Rolf funds. Some of the livable community dollars are being turned back because cities cannot use them. And it seems to me that given the dire straits we're in, that although this is on its own a distasteful proposition, and I think Mr. Bell would say that as well, it is one that is approaches a possibility so that our transit system just doesn't go in the tank.
Mr. Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Chairman Bell, my communities are concerned that as we move out of the recession, while your numbers look dire for 2008, we have to remember that the private sector had a credit crash as well, so the projects that were on their way to completion or in process of being built suffered from the private sector crash, not necessarily the fact that the communities have done anything wrong. And my concern is that by zeroing out the livable communities funds, there is nothing there as we try to get out of it, as the credit market straightens out, as we're trying to create jobs and get the other thing this committee does is housing. And so I'm concerned that there won't be any funds at all for communities that are ready to count on this money and are ready to move ahead with projects. And I'm just wondering if there is an alternative to complete zero on this and what your suggestions on how we get these projects going that were kind of in the pipeline and have been for a long time. We do know that these projects take usually several years in order to start and complete.
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, first one point of clarification. We only are asking for authority to take up to 75%, 50 to 75%. And Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, my hope is this, that there would be a balance, that as MVEST receives, if the economy does recover, my hope is and my belief is that it won't just recover in the real estate area, the development area, but it'll also recover in terms of auto sales. So if, in fact, the economy recovers, auto sales pick up, MVEST revenues start trending up, then our need to dip into those livable community levies will go down. My hope is that auto sales will pick up as well as commercial development, and if that happens, we will then need to go into those livable community accounts much less or by a corresponding amount. I want to say very, very clearly and echo what Senator Ress said. I am a strong supporter of the REL Fund. I'm a strong supporter of the Livable Communities program. And when we came up with this proposal, we intentionally had a provision where it blinks back on so that it sends a strong message that we want to fully fund that again and fully levy for that again.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Chair Bell brings up a good point, which is we hope the MVEST comes back. Well, when we flip the major source of funding in 2001 to the motor vehicle sales tax with some ongoing general fund support for transit operations in the metro area, immediately we started exposing ourselves to quite a bit of volatility and kind of a lack of commitment both in the general fund and the motor vehicle sales tax in terms of the proportion. Now we have the constitutional amendment, but we're pulling in less because no one's buying any cars. But my question is, now we have this law that says we have to We have to achieve structural balance. We have to balance into the subsequent biennium. Are we relying on MVEST forecast to fulfill the requirements of that law, or are we not in fulfillment of the requirements of that law, or what's the story in terms of structural balance going into the next biennium?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that is a very important and very difficult question. This addresses our problem through 10 and 11. It does not address our problem in 12 and 13. We, much like the rest of state government and the federal government, see huge problems at that time. Two flickers of bright lights, perhaps. One is that we hope to use some of the stimulus dollars, some of the remaining stimulus dollars, in ways that will give us positive tails into 12 and 13, coupled with MVEST coming back. Will that be enough in 12 and 13? Quite candidly, I doubt if it will be, but it won't be as dire as it is now. But members, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't want to lead you to believe anything other than we've got a structural problem here, as Senator Dibble has pointed out, and it is a real concern for me for 12 and 13.
Any other questions of this witness? Senator Dibble.
I just need to make one more point, Mr. Chair, and that is if we do the fare increase, Chairman Bell has heard me say this 100 times, the base fare was $1.50, and we added a quarter last year. We're contemplating another 50 cents. That's, a 50% increase in a family or an individual's transportation costs, for folks who rely on transit. We haven't asked anyone in Minnesota to increase their transportation budget by 50%. And 50 cents doesn't sound like a lot. Aggregate that over a month, and you're talking about really, really negatively impacting family budgets. People cannot afford that 75-cent addition to their daily, or it's really $1.50 because it's twice a day. Per day, every day they take the bus back and forth, I think that would be extremely damaging to families, combined with the service reductions that we're contemplating. I really hope we don't do that.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Let there be no mistake. I've voted, I think, for every transit bill that's ever come along, and I support transit 2,000%, but I just think it's coming from the wrong spot. I mean, I sympathize, and I want to get you your money to run the railroads and the buses, but I don't know. It's apples and oranges. I mean, you take some money out of a brownfield, a contaminated property, and that property is not going away. It's still there, and they need to rectify that kind of stuff, then to move it into operations. So it just doesn't seem like the right fit for me, and I don't know where else we could look. I just don't think it's the right spot to take it from a so-called investment account to operations account or an operation account. And I'm for transit, but I just... And you're looking for ways to do things, and I understand that, too.
Okay, members, we have a number of people who would like to testify against this. Do you have any more people that want to say something for it? Senator Rest?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Then Patricia Nauman from Metro Cities, Kevin Carroll from the City of Minneapolis. We got a couple of chairs there, so let's do two at a time. Ms. Nauman, please say your name for the record.
You. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We represent 85 cities in the metro area before both the legislature and the Met Council. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill. It's an understatement to say that we have significant concerns with the direction of this legislation. We would respectfully ask the committee to oppose the bill before you today. We appreciate the significant challenges that the Met Council has in funding its transit operating deficit, but we are concerned that this bill would really endanger a program that helps communities to reach important regional goals like land reuse, compact development, affordable housing, and land cleanup. We also think it does relatively little to address the transit gap, and certainly it doesn't do much to address it structurally, so we would be concerned about that. We're also very concerned about the precedent that would be set in allowing for this transfer, especially without structural solutions on the table to solve the deficit. Although there's a sunset in the bill, we think that without any structural solutions, that could easily become a long-term solution to this problem. We also, I handed out in your packet is a spreadsheet that put together that is a compilation of Met Council's annual reports to the legislature on the livable communities programs. Got a few things there showing what they award each year and for each program. And then in the bottom half of that shows the number of jobs created each year for a total of over 33,000 jobs. The resulting private and public investment, which is over $6.9 billion. New rental and ownership housing, as well as rehabbed housing, over 13,000 units, and areas of cleaned up land, over 1,700 acres. This is a very successful program. It is consistently oversubscribed. There are always, sometimes there are program funds that get relinquished, or there's a carryover, whether that's because a project didn't end up going through or whether it didn't cost as much. So we would argue that there's ebb and flow to the reduced demand for these programs at times. I would also argue that some of the ebb in the demand might be a result of the sort of ever-shifting guidelines and the more stringent guidelines that have been placed on these programs in recent years by the Met Council. But ultimately, we think this is just, it's a really strong program. It's a good program. It's a successful program. Particularly in a weak economy, we think it's important not to eliminate resources that help cities to continue work that ultimately leads to jobs, business growth, economic growth, and stronger tax bases. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Carroll.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Carroll. My job title technically is Principal Project Coordinator for the City of Minneapolis. My informal title is Brownfields Program Coordinator. Before working for the City of Minneapolis, I also had exposure to brownfields issues in suburban settings. I was the Community Development Director in the City of Farmington for 5 years, and before that served a 4-year term in the Rosemount City Council and a 6-year term on the Rosemount Port Authority Commission, which is its economic development arm. So I've dealt with brownfields for a number of years. In Minneapolis, it constitutes probably 75% of my workload for most of the year, and I'm happy to come here today to tell you how much we love the TBRA program. And many other cities do. It's an important component of every city's overall brownfields program. As you're probably aware, most cities, including the City of Minneapolis, don't have money to handle brownfields remediation. So my role basically is to be a facilitator for the other entities' programs. What I do is help promote those programs, including the TBRA program. I serve as a source of information to developers and environmental consultants. As you probably are also aware, in most cases, developers and property owners can't submit their grant applications directly to the Met Council or to Deed or to Hennepin County. They have to submit them through another governmental entity. So part of my responsibility is taking these applications to the City Council, getting their approval and consent, and then submitting them to the grantors. I have had discussions with Met Council representatives. I think I do understand part of the argument in favor of the bill. It's a challenging issue, admittedly. What I hear the most often, I think, is that there either is or they anticipate that there will be reduced demand for the funds. And I think that breaks down into two subparts. The first part, I think, relates to statistics that you hear from time to time regarding grant funds that were awarded and not actually used. Now, many of these grant programs have 2 or, in some cases, 3-year terms. And when you get toward the end of the term, sometimes it begins to appear as if the project's not going to go forward or not going to succeed. And there's been a little more of that lately, I will admit, because of the financial circumstances. Some projects have been delayed, and some statistics may make it appear as if there's less demand for the funds because grants that were awarded aren't being drawn down. The reality is that many of those projects are not dead. They've simply been delayed. So I don't know that that's necessarily a strong argument in favor of eliminating the funding. The other subpart of the argument regarding reduced demand, I think, involves projections regarding whether there will be demand for these funds in the future. And earlier today, I was putting the finishing touches on a staff report that I'll be submitting to the Minneapolis City Council within the next few days. That's based on grant applications that we received for the upcoming grant round, the one that the TBRA program is not part of. It's got the May 1 application deadline. And I have seen some interesting statistics over the course of the last year, and I thought maybe the numbers would be helpful to you. In the May round of last year, the economy wasn't great then, but it wasn't as bad as it is now. In the May 1 round, the city of Minneapolis received 16 grant applications for the three grant programs for a total of 10 projects, which is typical for the years that preceded that. 6 months later, in November of 2008, we received 24 applications for 19 projects. We almost doubled the number of projects that were seeking grant funds and a 50% increase in the number of individual applications. And for the staff report that I was finishing up today, it's even greater than that. We had 27 individual grant applications on 20 individual projects. And you can also look at the dollar amounts. In May of 2008, the total amount sought from all of the grantors, including the TBRA program, was about $2.1 million. 6 months later, in November of 2008, that went up to $3.0 million. And for the current round, it's $3.47, or almost $3.5 million. So over the last three grant rounds at six-month intervals, there's been a continuing increase in the number of projects seeking funds, the number of grant applications submitted, and the dollar value being sought by those projects. And because I'm immersed in this on a day-to-day basis, I was wondering why this was happening at a time when people talk about the economy being bad. So I've asked many of the applicants and the developers and the environmental consultants, and the two common explanations that I get, which I think are consistent with what I heard from the committee earlier. Number one, they say, we're trying to be proactive. We know the economy is going to turn around. We think it's on the horizon. We want to position ourselves for that type of development. So we want to apply now, number one, to get funds to investigate sites we think are contaminated. And if we've already done the investigation, we want to apply for funds to clean them up so that when the financial situation gets better, we're in a position to move forward with our project, which seems very sensible to me. The other reason that I hear about why we're seeing increased demand for the funds is because, in all candor, there are many projects in a better economy that really didn't need the money. They went ahead and developed the sites on their own. They didn't want to get into the grant program because, frankly, there's some long lags in the program. You apply for the funds, you wait for the result, you get the award, you do the paperwork. Often it's at least 8 or 9 months, in some cases a year, from the time that you apply until the time that you actually have the money available. And many developers couldn't wait that long. But in the current economy, what they say to me is, you know, the banking situation is so bad and the margins are so tight and the loan-to-value ratios have changed so much, we can't make this project go without environmental remediation funds. So they are going to these grant programs that they have not previously gone to simply because of the financial circumstances. And I think that's likely to continue. Great. So with that, I guess I would one other point I wanted to make. There's a significant gap that's created in the landscape without the TBRA funds, and it's very specific. The TBRA program provides environmental investigation funds that can be used to investigate commercial and industrial sites. For many years, the Met Council has been the primary source of those funds, and I've directed people to the Met Council to get those funds because in Minneapolis, Hennepin County has geared their program to kind of fit gaps in the TBRA and DEED programs. They make investigation funds available, but almost exclusively for residential sites. They don't make any available for commercial and industrial. With the DEED program, there's a relatively limited amount of money available for investigation. In most past grant rounds, it's been about $125,000 per round for the entire state. And with many complex projects, the amount of money needed to investigate the site is $40,000 or $50,000. So you may be looking at only two or three or four investigation grant applications from DEED for the entire state of Minnesota. I've heard some things lately about DEED maybe doubling that to $250,000 a round, but still you're looking at only five or six or seven investigation grants for the entire state. And in all candor, most of that money ends up going to greater Minnesota for a variety of reasons, leaving relatively little for the metro area. So you take DEED out of the picture, you take Hennepin County out of the picture because of the way they structure the program, you take TBRA out of the picture, you have no good source of brownfields funding to do the investigations on sites that are necessary to kindle redevelopment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carroll. We have three more witnesses that would like to testify against this. Why don't you come up, Greg Miller, Lori Lauder, and Gina Siganic. And if you could, don't repeat what we just heard, okay? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay.
My name is Greg Miller, and I'm a principal and president of a commercial real estate development company entitled Interstate Partners. And we are a regionally-based real estate development company. And we have been recipients of these funding sources as recently as last year. I brought brochures that can be distributed to the members of the committee. We acquired the St. Paul Stockyards. We are in the process of redeveloping those.
South St. Paul Stockyards.
South St. Paul Stockyards.
You're going to lose me.
Since I'm the owner of the property, I should understand that. But, apologize, Senator. All right. The South St. Paul Stockyards.
Because if there is a big difference.
I understand that. I office in St. Paul,
that's
so
like,
I understand.
That's like getting Hibbing and Chisholm wrong.
Start a hockey war here.
Yeah.
And these funds are critical to the development of these types of properties. We have received funding from a variety of sources. We put in our own money into this property, but as you may be aware, there's methane, there's a buried asbestos from past activities. There were oil issues. There were a variety of brownfield issues that we had to deal with. And without the funding from these sources, we would not have been able to proceed with this development. We plan on building a building this year. The economy is not dead, contrary to what you read in the papers. There still is an economy out there. But albeit the source of private capital, I've been in this 35 years, and I have to go back to my days in the early 70s to find capital is difficult to obtain. So any kind of public funding cuts at this point for these types of developments would be a severe blow to our efforts to try to build buildings. I understand the transit issue just from a private perspective. One of the reasons why we're developing this park, we also developed a 100-acre business park in Eagan. We also did a 200-acre park in Shoreview, is because they're near the sources of transit and near the sources of jobs. By redeveloping inside the ring, we're able to bring jobs closer in and maybe eliminate some of the needs for transit. If you stop the brownfield developments to give more money to transit, as a developer, to me, what you're sending the message and saying was, let's keep pushing the development out where there are no issues and there is cheap land, because that's what's going to happen. So.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Lauder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lori Lauder, Director of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority. I've been in charge of our brownfields programs for the past 16 years. I do have a letter if this could be handed out as well. Mr. Chair and members, I'll try to be pretty brief here. Just wanted to mention that, as you know, brownfield sites are distressed and defective sites. They don't work in the marketplace, and they're dirty. And the Port Authority has worked on brownfield sites for 35 to 40 years now with an incredible production rate, and a lot of that has to do with the provision to the Port Authority of TBRA funds out of the Met Council, from the Met Council, to help fill the gap. As you probably know, when we work on brownfield sites, we need to cobble together a variety of funds, both on the debt side and the equity side, so that the project can help repay the debt side. And then on the equity side, deed funds, Met Council funds, EPA funds, and so forth are very critical. Met Council, of course, provides funding that allows for asbestos cleanup and lead abatement, unlike the other funds available to us. A little point about, Mr. Chair, about production rates. These projects fulfill the federal, state, and local and Met Council economic development goals. These are in terms of jobs, not just permanent jobs, which are very significant, but also construction jobs. And these jobs, as you know, are not just provided in the metro area as far as construction jobs, but these jobs are provided likely for a significant portion of the state in two ways. When the jobs, construction jobs, are being provided through the redevelopment process, as well as when our business customers provide their own new facility construction. So that is significant. So this is all about not just the sites themselves and the cobbling together of money. It's also about the economic activity and the spin-off activity that happens as a result of these projects. And finally, Mr. Chair, I'd like to talk about, as is indicated in your letter, three examples of the terrific leverage. And we do thank Chairman Bell and his staff for working so well with economic development agencies such as the Port Authority. In the Williams Hill Business Center, which is just a quarter mile from here, Mr. Chair, there was a $19 private investment amount for every $1 of TBRA funds. And as you can see in the first page of your letter, there were 12 jobs to begin with thereabouts, and now we have over 450 jobs. And there was just a dramatic increase in property taxes as well, from $30,000 to begin with to over $730,000 today per year. Just a few miles, mile or two to the west of here at the Great Northern Quarter Business Center, there was $8 in private sector investment provided for every $1 of Met Council funds. Again, as you see, 20 jobs transformed into 480 jobs on this site, and as you see, $85,000 per year and almost $700,000 per year after construction in annual property taxes. The economic development throw-off from these projects, thanks to Met Council funds, is incredibly important. And lastly, Mr. Chair, at our Westminster Business Center, which is located about a half mile from downtown from this site, there was over $22 in private sector investment for every $1 in Met Council funds provided out of the TBRA funds. And again, going from 30 jobs to over 900 jobs, and annual property taxes going from $45,000 a year to over $1.8 million a year. This is a site that is not only absolutely full, but also has a lot of dense development as well with some medical office buildings. So, Mr. Chair, I wanted to give you some numerics here. I hope that is helpful, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Gina? And there, are there any questions of these witnesses? Senator Gulash.
Mr. Chair, just wondering how many sites are on the St. Paul books at this point in time for this TBR?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kelesh, we have several sites, one to the west of here in Great Northern Quarter, which has just been awarded Met Council funds on Pierce Butler and Milton. And the largest site that we've done in a while is on the east side. We've just acquired 35 acres of the former 3M property that's been abandoned. And so we have a very significant effort. As your letter mentions, we are looking at least 1,000 jobs coming out of that, with a significant amount of construction jobs as well. So we have a lot going on here.
Just to follow up, and what kind of dollars are you talking about needing from the TBRA funds?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kelesh, we are still identifying the needs for that large east side site. We are almost finished with our due diligence at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Gina?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record, please.
My name is Gina Saganik. I'm with AON, which is a nonprofit housing developer. I'm the vice president of housing development. I've been involved in community development and affordable housing issues for nearly 17 years. I'm here today to speak in opposition of the bill, which is hard for me to do in some ways because the Met Council has been a great friend and a great supporter of affordable housing, and this is a tough decision because transportation is also very important for all of us to start to use for the environment. I won't be redundant, but I will say I agree with everything folks have been saying here. AON, who is about the second largest provider of affordable housing in the state, has just about every project we do utilizes these funds, and anywhere from about $300,000 to $500,000 on average, even up to $1 million. So losing these funds would create significant holes in our ability to produce this housing and make differences in the environmental impacts. I just wanted to talk a little bit about basic needs. We all know our basic needs as human beings, starting with air and water and food. And housing is very, very high on that list. So taking away money from something that's so critical to being able to function well as human beings is a very unfortunate decision. Especially in this environment, as you know, with the foreclosures and unemployment, et cetera, we operate nearly 1,700 units of affordable housing and have seen that demand increase significantly. We're turning lots of folks away, or we have very, very long waiting lists. We do have about 256 units that are pending development this year. We do have some gaps, so again, taking money away is not the way to move these developments forward. So we really would love to see the change in the environment, additional jobs, and places for people to live. So pushing forward is the most important thing to do now. As far as undersubscribed, I could attest I could apply for a lot more of those funds, and I could probably use up whatever was underutilized. And there has been some changes in the eligibility requirements, which decrease what we can ask for. But we would love to work with someday to fix that out. And then in conclusion, I would like to say something that was said earlier, that with all due respect to this idea and wanting to figure out how to make this all work, it was said that this is not a great proposal. And I think that is something we need to think about. If it's not a great proposal, we need to figure out a better way to make this happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments, Senator Dibble?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's what I'm asking for. I'm asking for ideas for a better proposal. If this is not a great proposal, because I'm sure the local communities and folks who care about housing and jobs and economic development and the like also understand that people need to get to jobs, and they need to get home, and they need to get to places. I was on the Legislative Commission to End Poverty, and we certainly learned that huge barriers to self-sufficiency and huge barriers to, you know, or huge parts of the systemic issues that keep people trapped in poverty were economic development, vitality, the availability of jobs, where people live. But what came up time and again in every corner of the state, whether we were in, you know, the urban core or first, second, third tier suburbs, or out in greater Minnesota or the regional centers, was transportation. And I think that was a surprise to a lot of my commission members. It wasn't a surprise to me because I've been working on this issue for a long time, but that was always mentioned either first or second by the local communities, those who were experiencing poverty themselves or those who worked with folks in poverty, was transportation as a significant barrier to people's ability to provide for themselves and build a stable, secure life. So I again ask folks who are working on housing, folks who are working on economic development at the local jurisdiction, if this doesn't, you know, if we need to keep these funds where they are, then, you know, we need an alternative. We don't have one on the table right now. And we've got contemplating a 25% cut in transit operations. That means we pretty much dismantle our transit system in the metropolitan area.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to echo Senator Dibble's comments, and certainly he is he's a leader on the Transportation Committee in this area and probably understands it, all of the nuances and the complexities of finding adequate ways to keep our transit system going in the metropolitan area for the next couple of years. And when I say this isn't a great proposal, it's nothing that we would offer in a time when we don't have a deficit. And I would suggest that that's true. That's going to be true in every single area of the budget. It's true in K-12. We're going to see a bill tomorrow where we're going to be asked to cut $273 per pupil. Is that a great proposal? No, it's a terrible proposal. It is a terrible proposal, but I bet there are going to be a bunch of us who vote for it. Is this a great proposal? No, but is it a proposal that's going to work, that will salvage and keep our transit system going in the metropolitan area for the next couple of years without doing undue burden or damage to the proposals of the people who are opposing it? Yes, it can do that. None of these are pretty proposals.
Senator Kilash.
Mr. Chair, Chairman Bell, I'm looking for a balance here, I guess. I'm wondering, quite frankly, if we can't tap less, change that, if we changed line 2.4 to 50%, what does that actually do to your budget, and how much extra funds are then available for the livable communities and the and how would you make up the difference?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, I do appreciate your suggestion. What we are asking for is maximum flexibility in uncharted waters. We really don't know what's going to happen to MVEST over the next months and a couple of years. And the reason why we wanted to go up to 75% is so that we would not have to come back to this body and ask for additional authority. It is my hope not to go up to the 75% and that we will be able to do make do with perhaps only going to 50% into the demonstration account or into the Ralph account or into the TIBRA account. I want to be clear on one point, too. We are not touching the affordable housing account. Mm-hmm. There's $1.5 million in that. We are not touching that. But the other three, the demonstration account, TIBRA account, and the Ralph account, we are giving or requesting authority to go up to 75%. If we were statutorily limited to 50%, then we run more of a risk that we would not, MVEST would not come back and we would not be able to meet our budget. And in that scenario, Mr. Chair and Senator Kalish, we would have to look at either expediting the fare increase or going from 25 cents to 50%. Or route cuts. In sum, very quickly, what we are requesting that this committee do is what everyone, as Senator Resta said, across the political spectrum is being asked to do, which is to prioritize our services. Transit is at a peak now, a 27-year high, 82 million rides, and the Livable Communities Demonstration Account does not have the demand that it once did. And so, to me, it's only prudent and makes sense to give us authority to move a levy from an area that does not have the same degree of utilization. That shouldn't be confused with the same degree of importance, but it doesn't have the same level of utilization and allow us to use those funds in an area where the demand is going through the roof. I view transportation as second only to education in facilitating upward mobility. And I don't want to be forced into a situation where we are hiring a construction worker to work in one of our demonstration account programs. At the same time, I'm laying off a bus driver. That, to me, just does not make sense, and I hope we would not be forced to do that.
Mr. Chair, Chairman Bell, is that the only alternative, is to shrink the system if we go to 50%? Well, and my other question would be, on a timeline, this is a biennium. In next year's session, would it be able to be adjusted in time for you to still meet your goals or not? Part of it is I'm concerned that these communities have no ability to plan on how much funding is available through the TIBRA program, for example.
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, a couple of first, no, that's not necessarily the only strategy that we would have. I want to play the Washington Monument Syndrome and say that this is the only possible thing that we could do. But it would make it much more likely. I would be disingenuous if I didn't say that. We would have to look at what happened to MVEST. We could look at using more of our reserves, but I'm very, very hesitant to do that because I think that that's imprudent to do that. None of us want to burn through all of our reserves. We need to have a bit of a cushion there. We are maximizing the utilization of the stimulus dollars that will be coming in. We can only move so many of those into this activity, and so we are at the high water mark in that. We would look at other things that we might be able to piece together, but I don't want to hold out false promise there either. It would make it much more likely of a fare increase and route reductions. And that's something that these same cities don't want. I had my friends from AMM up here a minute ago, and yet if this does not go through, the suburban transit providers whose mayors really like those suburban services might get cut, and that would be something that would be of concern to those mayors and, I suspect, AMM and certainly us. This is not a good proposal. This is not something that I think, other than the circumstances we're in, I would want to move forward in, because I'm a strong supporter of those. But we all have to prioritize in this economic environment, and to me, this is a prudent, reasonable, middle ground solution.
Senator Metzen.
Well, it's not a good solution. And I don't think there's any. I don't think it's critical, Mr. Chairman, that we have to act on this today. I just think we should look under every rock. And I at the end of the day, I guarantee you, Chairman Bell, that I'm going to vote for something to fund the people that are driving these buses. But I just don't know if this is the best option today. I'm going to be there when you need me, but taking the money out of this pot just troubles me, and I think in the next week or two we could take a week off and probably all be thinking a little bit more, and I know how tough money is, I just a little uncomfortable today, and this might be the best proposal 10 days from now. I don't know that. It's not today for me, but that's where I got it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Just a response to Senator Kielash, too, in terms of being able to plan for the future.
Yeah.
Most of those dollars are all competitively bid, and so nobody can really count on them in terms of – you can't put it in your budget.
Thank
so
you.
That is I don't think that that's particularly comforting, but it is the truth.
Thank you.
Chairman, I don't know this. So I'd like to just table this for the time being. And
is that a motion?
Yes, that's a motion.
That's
Mr. Chairman, that's fine with me.
That's non-debatable, I believe.
We'll get it done.
Okay.
It's fine with me.
All right. Senator Metzen then moves to table Senate File 1610. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, motion is
adopted. No.
Thank you all very much. Senator Olson. Senator Olson, Senate File 1764.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate File 1764 is a bill that would create a venture capital fund that would create an opportunity to stimulate the economy or an opportunity for economic development that would be a partnership between state government, local government, and business enterprises that would be that would be evaluated according to some criteria that are set forth in this bill. Mr. Chair, as you know, we've had a number of discussions in this committee, and we actually just took a tour here this session looking at the JobZ program and that approach toward giving assistance to businesses starting to try to promote business development. And there have been some areas of the state and even some communities in my district that have had some limited success with the JobZ program. But as the state auditor's report showed, there have all and as we saw firsthand when we visited Senator Ortman's district, there have been some downsides to that program as well, both in terms of its cost to taxpayers and what happens when we have one community that has a difficult time competing with another community that has this program offered, or as in some of the cases that happened in my district, a tax advantage given to a business owner who might move from one community to another smaller community without really doing much except kind of reallocating where those jobs occur. We also heard when we visited the Humphrey Institute earlier at the beginning of session that one of the difficulties, and I don't think anyone can pick up a paper today without knowing that one of the difficulties business entrepreneurs are having is just getting access to funds, getting access to the kind of capital that they would need to promote a new idea. And so this approach that's in this bill for promoting the economy or promoting business development in Minnesota is really more of a bottom-up rather than a top-down type of approach, because it would make venture capital available to people who are citizens of the state and have ideas that would be evaluated uniquely in terms of what a local government thought would work for their community. So it isn't a one-size-fits-all approach. It would be something where a local community, a city or a county, would make a grant application on a competitive basis to the state through deed. And the grant application would be evaluated based on the criteria that are in Subdivision 5 of the bill, which essentially are criteria that are things that, as a matter of good public policy, the state would like to promote. And so I could go through all of these, but they are listed there in Subdivision 5. Basically, if a community had a building or an area of that community that needed redevelopment, and so there is a building that's sitting empty or that needs some rehabilitation of some type, and the owner of the building doesn't have the capital available to or isn't able to get capital to rehab the building, that would be one criteria. Using federal stimulus money so that the state takes the most advantage of those potential funds from the federal government would be another criteria. Meeting our renewable energy standards is the third criteria, or helping to meet those renewable energy standards. And number four is related, reducing greenhouse gases and dependency on fossil fuels. Number five would be assisting resident entrepreneurs and businesses to initiate or expand in a manner that creates sustainable jobs compatible with resources available in that area. And one of the economic development, someone from my area suggested that perhaps on line 2.19, we might want to consider adding between sustainable and jobs the phrase living wage to make sure that the jobs are not just low-paying types of jobs.
Do you want to add that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I would make a motion that on line 2.19, we amend the bill to, after the word sustainable, insert living wage.
Okay. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion
aye.
Adopted. Senator Olson.
On line 2.20, supporting research and development of innovative non-traditional uses of resources that are, again, available specific to that area. 2.22, integrate support services and businesses in a central location. That would be typically what happens when you have an incubator model like we saw here in the metro area when we heard from the heard about that model. And then line 2.23, reaches out to certain populations that are underrepresented in the workforce. So, in other words, making a specific effort to employ those that might not be normally or readily employable in the workforce. Now, that was my menu of ideas based on discussions I've had with people who work in economic development in our area and just different things I've heard being a member of this committee over the last couple of years. It may not be an exhaustive list. I'm certainly open to or would welcome suggestions for other things that might be added to that list. But the idea is not that a grant would have to meet all of these criteria. It might meet several of them. It might only meet one of them. But that would be something for the state to be able to evaluate based on the strength of that particular proposal. And in that application, what that local community is saying about the needs of that community and how those needs would best be served. Then finally, I think something else that makes this proposal different than the JobZ proposal is that it's not necessarily geared specifically toward one geographic area of the state over another or even that it's got static criteria, but what it says is that DEED would evaluate where these funds are most needed on a year-to-year basis based on considering the rate of unemployment in that area, the applicant's area, and the average household income in the area where from where the applicant came, so that we would be really trying to make this money available where it is most needed in a given year. I think if we're trying to stimulate economic growth, we only have limited funds available, and really trying to make sure they're directed where they would be most used would be the idea behind this bill. Then what would happen with these loan funds, this venture capital fund would be in the form of loans made, a zero or low interest loan, the local government would have the flexibility, together with the determination made at deed. I'm presuming that if the money was going to be paid with a little interest, that might be given a little bit higher consideration by deed, but if it was necessary to make it a no-interest fund to get the money, and it had enough merit, that would be an argument the local government could make. But then the money would be repaid back to the state, but the community would be prioritized for another grant application from its community if they made a wise investment decision. So if they'd been successful in getting this money repaid to the state, then they would have a higher priority to have another grant application made in the future. There is no dollar amount appropriated, Mr. Chair, but Senator Bach has asked that this bill, if it passes this committee, be referred to his division to see what he can do. And so I think it would probably be most appropriate to leave that blank. I'm not sure your thoughts.
We love blanks around here.
Senator
Olson, you've got a couple of witnesses, so why don't you?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I have the privilege of having here both the former and present mayor of Pequot Lakes. And so I'll turn it over to the present mayor,
okay.
Nancy.
Thank you for allowing me to be here today to speak in favor of Senate File 1764, the Minnesota Business Venture Capital Program. My name is Nancy Adams, and I am the current mayor of Pequot Lakes, a town approximately of 2,000 people, close to about 25 miles north of Brainerd. Like many small...
My wife used to have a cabin there.
Aha.
And then
bring her back.
Well, her mother sold her before I found out about
it. Oh,
her.
Dear. That's really a shame.
Yeah.
We'd love to have you back. Trust me. Like many small cities in Minnesota, businesses in Pequot Lakes have to work really hard and have sound, creative business plans to succeed. The current economic downturn makes challenge even more challenging. While years ago you might have described Pequot as a tourist destination, today we have a mix of businesses that make us more of a year-round destination. However, with the broad economic problems already mentioned, we unfortunately have more empty storefronts than we are desirable and that we would like to see. And we're always looking for ideas outside the box. Senator Olson and I have talked about this on several occasions. When she mentioned to me the concept of the business venture program, I thought it was just the type of initiative that would clearly benefit Pequot Lakes and other towns similar to ours. The owners of empty storefronts face several dilemmas. Their buildings are often worth less than they paid for. The majority of the buildings are older and definitely need upgrading, and potential businesses too that want to rent those business places can't break even when faced with the expected rents. What is the answer? Our idea is that hopefully with a revolving loan fund available, the city could convince building owners to upgrade their buildings and help them understand that having new business paying somewhat lower rents will eventually be better for them, the community, and the new businesses rather than having just an empty building. Further, we're working to have energy audits done on every single empty building in town so that when the time arrives, those business store owners will understand how to proceed with maintenance and upgrades appropriately. We have been very frugal with our budget process in Pequot Lakes, and our citizens are pleased. Our community needs help, though, and 95% of our budget comes from our levy, which for 2009 was raised by only 1.07%. With the loss of the LGA, we truly have no way to assist the many businesses in our community that need help, and those also looking for jobs. Senate File 1764 would provide assistance for our community. And thank you again for allowing me to present this afternoon.
Thank you, Ms. Adams. Kathy?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Kathy Malika. I was the former mayor for the city of Pequot Lakes and currently serve on the city council. Senate Bill 1764 would be such an asset to help small communities compete with larger communities which have the draw of the big box stores. As you know, tourism is crucial to the state of Minnesota, and several small communities depend on tourism to keep their communities productive. However, the cost of doing business has escalated to heights that make it difficult to cash flow a business in small towns. Nancy and I have been working hard to develop a program in our community in a large empty building. The funds from this bill would assist us in providing spaces at lower rents and help the owner of the building to make the necessary upgrades. This, in turn, would bring new businesses to our community, keep established businesses in our community by assisting them to enlarge, and also we are working with people within our community who produce products and need a storefront with space to ship their products to others. A project like this creates jobs not only for the renter, but also for the craftsmen that are needed to update the buildings. We as a small town have no way to offer grants or low or no interest loans. And by using a tool like Senate File 1764, we could build a strong base for our business community and help the small businessmen who we all know are the backbone of our economy. And I'd like to thank you for permitting us to be here and testify on behalf of this bill.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Olson, as long as our motion has to be, then we have to move it to finance, because once it goes out here, it goes to finance, and then finance will move to taxes. So, okay, so Senator Olson will move then that Senate File 1764 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. As amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion adopted. Thank you all very much.
Thank you both for coming.
It was a pleasure meeting you. Senator Kubley.
Senator Kubley, Senate File 2014.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2014 is a bill that would give an appropriation to Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota for their credit counseling program. Currently, I think LSS is one of only two organizations in the state that belongs to the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, which is it's an organization that sets a pretty high standard for credit counselors. But they're experiencing a high demand for credit counseling services at the current time, and I think, you know, that they do need to expand that service with some of the problems that their clientele are experiencing at the present time. With me today is Mr. Darrell Dahlheimer, who is the program manager for the financial counseling program at Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota, and I'd like to give him the opportunity to address the committee.
Certainly. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Darrell Dahlheimer, excuse me, and I'm a program director at Lutheran Social Service Financial Counseling in charge of the financial counseling program of LSS statewide. I'm here to offer testimony on behalf of Senate File 2014, a bill for capacity building of the financial counseling services of Lutheran Social Service. As Senator Kubley mentioned, we are the only National Foundation for Credit Counseling member in the state of Minnesota with statewide capacity to serve all of Minnesota. And we've been experiencing a booming business, I'm sorry to say, on behalf of America's consumers. We're a booming business in not only foreclosure prevention, but also simply debt and budget counseling demand, as America's consumers are facing the recession and an escalating personal finance debt that rivals what the federal government's talking about on a national level. So I'd like to let you just have a little background. We serve a lot of Minnesotans. We last year served 18,000 Minnesotans. But to give you an idea of what that means for us, in the year 2005, we served 3,000 families. And by the next year, it was 5,000. By the next year, in 2007, it had doubled again to 10,000. And now we're at 18,000 and growing. And it breaks my heart to tell you, I'd like to just summarize three quick pieces of testimony. The first is that at this point, because we are unable to keep up with capacity, we are turning away 50 people per day. They call seeking services, and by the way, we have several hundred that call, but every day 50 people call our main service center statewide and are told that there is a 6 to 8 week waiting list, a waiting list we've been unable to dent because of capacity issues and a lack of infrastructure funding. 6 to 8 week waiting list, and at that point, 50 people per day turn away, which is 1,000 per month. 1,000 Minnesotans every month are seeking services from a legitimate consumer credit counseling service that can help them with debt management, budget and debt counseling. In other words, they're doing the right thing, but we have no capacity to serve them, and they're recognizing that because consumers cannot wait 6 to 8 weeks for this service. It's something that's very time sensitive. So the first piece of testimony is to tell you we're a bit underwater, and we have a model that works. In fact, once we get caught up, it's a fantastic model that becomes self-supporting because as there are creditor donations and client fees for debt management services, having existing clients and having a base we can serve provides funding for operating purposes. What LSS and other similar consumer credit counseling services lack is capacity building capital to ramp up to meet the demand. And we, frankly, have been unable to meet this demand, and consumers are going elsewhere. So the second piece of testimony I'd like to offer is, where are consumers going? And I can answer that for you. Where they are going is the only other two alternatives once they have turned away from legitimate consumer credit counseling service. The first is unnecessary bankruptcy filings. Now, we recognize that bankruptcy is a legitimate option for people who are truly buried as a last resort. However, many of the people we see are turning from our services with a wait list to simply file because that's the only way they can see to avoid garnishment, judgment, and pain. And the second place they're turning is there's been an influx in the last 2 years of an industry that has been unheard of in Minnesota and, frankly, the upper Midwest until the last 2 years. It's called debt settlement. And in contrast to legitimate debt management services where a consumer takes full responsibility for living within a budget, paying their debt 100% in full to creditors, and making good turnaround in their personal finance and on their credit, in contrast, they're going to debt settlement services. And debt settlement services simply promise the consumer that they don't have to pay everything they owe, that they make a deal to the creditors, stop paying them, stop talking to them, and, of course, they wind up with garnishments and judgments, and the creditors don't get paid either. It's a lose-lose proposition. So I'm here with some passion, not just because I work for LSS and happen to believe in our mission, but because I see consumers every day. I want to remind you, currently tracking December, January, and February, 1,000 Minnesotans every month are being turned away. The third piece I'd like to just say is what are the benefits to appropriating this funds for us? What we can do with the amount we're asking for in this appropriation is to, within 3 to 4 months, put 13 new counselors on the line across Minnesota to be able to serve Minnesotans, which we predict will be able to serve in the next 2 years 26,000 families. We'll be more than able to double our capacity and output of this with an appropriation to be able to ramp up. I want to emphasize it would be self-supporting, and so it wouldn't be an ongoing issue. It would be an issue of giving us the funds that nonprofits lack, which is venture capital. We don't have the ability to seek venture capital in the private market, and God knows that market dried up anyway for a nonprofit place. What we do is turn to government. We've also tapped just about every foundation possible to get to our 18,000. So I would like to just say I think that this is an opportunity to give Minnesotans the capacity to do the right thing, to take responsibility to seek help for their debt and budget problems, to pay them in full through our debt management services, and to allow a trusted nonprofit with 140 years of Minnesota experience to do its work and do its work well. I'd be happy to entertain any questions, and I thank you for your interest in this subject.
Thank you, Mr. Dahlheimer. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dahlheimer, several of us, or at least several of us, I guess, on this committee sit on another committee, the Commerce Committee, where we had a lot of discussion about the debt settlement practices you referred to, and then we've heard this again today in Judiciary. And some of us, speaking for myself, I would tend to agree with you about the debt settlement companies. I know seven states have outlawed them, and I just think the idea of charging somebody money to tell them not to pay their bills and, you know, with no protection or no effort to even negotiate those bills up front is just, as you said, a lose-lose situation that isn't a good one to encourage. But I wonder if there isn't some kind of middle ground, and maybe you do this, but what would be the problem with talking to these creditors up front and seeing whether everyone wouldn't be better off to get some payments going? And do you have the authority to try to negotiate a lower payment where it's appropriate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, thank you. That's a very excellent question, and I should take a moment to explain what we can do. We believe in full taking responsibility for one's debt. However, we recognize that consumers are in trouble most of the time when they come to us. For example, with credit card debt, which is what drives most Americans' household debt, there are penalty rates of interest oftentimes from 27 to 35% APR. There's late fees of $35 every month. There's over-the-limit fees of $35 every month. So it simply takes one or two mistakes to create a world of pain on the personal finance level. And what we believe is possible is our debt management plans, which 2,400 Minnesotans use every month to pay their credit card debts. How it works is credit card companies recognize the role of legitimate, I emphasize legitimate, NFCC member credit counseling agencies, and they provide for the life of the debt, reduced interest, and stopping of all fees as that debt is paid through the agency to the creditors. So we find that consumers are actually quite pleased with the result, which is they want to pay their debt, they acknowledge their debt, but they don't want to be trapped in a lifetime of payments. A debt management plan, as offered through the NFCC and LSS, is 5 years maximum. It averages 3 to 4 years, and the payments are a standard 2% of the balance. But when you pay it, it pays the debt down because it's such reduced interest rates. So I think that the consumers are actually getting a great deal, and they recognize that, and the vast majority of them completed the plan.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Dahlheimer. So then who pays for your services? Does the person using your services pay for it, or does the credit card company pay for it, or both?
Mr. Dahlheimer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, again, thank you for helping me do my job about explaining how we work. The nonprofit credit counseling industry works like this. We believe that consumers really need access to services, so there is no fee to see us for budget and debt counseling. However, to fund such a thing, we do not have any federal funding for that. There is separate federal and state funding for housing and foreclosure prevention counseling, but there is no state nor federal funding for budget and debt counseling, which is crucial. How we fund that is donations from the credit card companies and fees from the clients specifically attached to the debt management plans. So in other words, as we're seeing a swath of, let's say, 100 consumers of Minnesota, most of whom are up to their eyeballs in debt, if 20 or 25 of those 100 turn into debt management plans, it raises revenue enough to pay for the free counseling for the majority of the people. Does that make sense? In other words, the debt management plans are the crucial funding mechanism for LSS. We also do have membership contracts. For example, 6 credit unions and 1 faith-based organization pay us a revenue each year to serve their members. But the concept of this is we have a self-sustaining model that's been working for over 20 years. What we don't have is any funding at all to increase our capacity.
Senator Olson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, just for comparison's sake, Mr. Dahlheimer, when you say you add that fee that you charge consumers to the repayment plan, just so we know what we're talking about, how much is that fee?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Dahlheimer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the fee that's allowed under debt management plans is a one-time startup fee of $35, and then a fee that's on a monthly basis based on the size of the program between $0 and $50 maximum each month, and the average amount that's being paid by consumers on the plan of the 2,400 is between $10 and $15 per month, so much less than a single late fee. The smallest debt management program I wrote was for a grandma who made a $33 payment each month to LSS for the creditors $3 of which was our fee. The largest was a $1,050 plan, of which $50 max was our fee.
Thank you for your testimony. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Kubley moves that Senate File 2014 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Economic Development and Housing Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair and members.
Senator Saltzman here? Well, she's making her way to the table, too, members. We have three additional bills, and we do need to be out of this room at 5:30 this evening for a caucus. So.
Get out.
Senator Saltzman with Senate File 292. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Senator. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'm here today with Senate File 292, which is called the Minnesota Business Investment Company Credit Act. And we have been doing a lot in our business committee. I know you have as well, about how do we create initiatives and incentives for those high-tech emerging companies that really have such great promise in our state. And we've talked a little bit about business and investment and tax, angel investor credits. And this is a little bit of a different program where insurance companies can invest in these pools, and up to $200 million is available to be used by qualifying companies to help their businesses. And it's rather exciting. It has been used in other states, and this particular bill, people are learning from it, and that we've learned from their mistakes and challenges and really developed a stronger proposal. Mr. Cassidy is here. The way it works is that an insurance company invests these funds, and they get back an 80% tax credit that is spread out over 4 years. And what's important to note here is that the money has to work for 4 years before they start to get the credit back. And so businesses are starting to be able to use these dollars, and it really does provide the capital that we're hearing repeatedly just is not out there, and really encouraging people who otherwise are not investing in these companies to look at these kind of investments, which are extremely important to Minnesota. As we've talked earlier, we have the research here. We have the ideas. It's getting them off the lab bench and getting them to the workplace. So at that, Mr. Cassidy, perhaps you'd like to talk a little bit about this and the specific fees that are in this bill that brought this to your committee.
Mr. Cassidy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard, Skadden, Dinard. I represent a coalition of venture capital firms, one of which is Enhanced Capital, the other Advantaged Capital. They have been working around the country, implementing these programs in 10 different states and jurisdictions around the country with a great deal of success. A number of states, including Texas, Missouri, the state of Wisconsin and Colorado, have implemented this program. New York just re-upped this program for $200 million more. A number of states are looking at this program to include in their economic stimulus packages, which I know many states around the country are doing during these hard economic times. It's pretty simple. Besides chronic unemployment, I think the biggest thing that we hear in committees day in and day out is the total lack of capital, whether you're a small, medium, or large business. This program targets businesses that are 100 employees or less that are based in Minnesota. As Senator Saltzman went over thoroughly, it would raise $200 million in investment capital from insurance companies, who obviously are one of the few places that actually has money right now in capital, and that is insurance companies that have reserves. In exchange for that, they would receive a tax credit after 4 years of the money going to work, and then each of the 4 years after that, they'd receive 20%. The reason we're here today is obviously we're in the Economic Development Committee, but more importantly, the Department of Economic Development would oversee this program, and the first thing that would happen is that the Department of Economic Development and the Commissioner would certify a number of companies, probably between 4 and 10 companies, that would be certified as investment managers to take a portion of the pool of capital and manage that capital and go find the businesses out on the street that actually need this capital to grow jobs and to grow revenue in the state of Minnesota. The theory being that after 4 years, the program will have paid for itself when the tax credits are to kick in. The registration fee for the initial certification is $7,500. Every year after that, the commissioner is responsible for auditing these companies each year, and the companies have to pay a $5,000 fee to participate in that audit. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll be be welcome to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Any further discussion from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Salzman. The tax credit, is that an income tax credit? That or what? Who's paying for the tax credit, basically?
Perhaps a question for Mr. Cassidy. Can I explain that in more detail?
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the tax credit would be an offset against the premium taxes that the company is liable for in the state of Minnesota. So a company, let's just pick a company, St. Paul Travelers. The liability they have in our state for paying premium taxes, which is the tax that they pay in our state based on the premium volume of what they have in this state, it would offset that premium tax liability.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chair, basically then, though it's not an income tax per se, but it's a tax, it's revenue that would go to the state's general fund that basically they wouldn't be paying then.
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. premium tax revenue goes to the general fund. Correct.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, but thank you. I think the argument is all the jobs that are grown will more than take care of that offset. I mean, probably quadruple the income taxes paid by the new job creations. Is that correct?
Senator Saltzman.
Right. Well, what's important, Mr. Chair, like to think about is that right now what we hear from companies is capital is just not available. And so we're looking at a lot of these programs as incentives. And insurance companies could invest these dollars anywhere. And this is really an incentive. And plus there is some risk here in that these companies are startup companies. And how do we leverage people and encourage them to invest in these startup companies that have such potential? The other issue in terms of a policy issue is that what we've seen repeatedly is that Minnesota still has great ideas. We just heard this in our business committee a couple hours ago from Dr. Mulcahy, who's been before you here as well, is that we have really invested in our research capacity and that we've got wonderful, exciting ideas here. If people want to move them forward, we're looking at people coming in from the East and West Coast and investing in them and then saying, now come home with me. So this is a way for us to grow capital in Minnesota and keep these companies here. Is there a cost to the state? Yes, there is. But the issue is, what does that really do in terms of leveraging jobs in the future and keeping these companies that have such potential here in this state?
Senator Metzen.
I think, did we hear that Wisconsin and two or three of our neighboring states have been doing that successfully for a few years? And I think we heard testimony that's why some companies started up in Wisconsin and not Minnesota, because of this plan that they have in place. Is that correct?
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, absolutely. One of the things that Wisconsin did that was unique is that the University of Wisconsin used a portion of their fund to transfer technology out of the University of Wisconsin into the marketplace. That is a tool that doesn't exist here at the University of Minnesota that I'm aware of. The University of Minnesota is always looking for some capital to get ideas out on the street and to commercialize some of the things that happen in their research laboratories. Wisconsin's been doing that fairly effectively for 10 years now with a portion of these funds that the same program was implemented in 1998.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Senator Saltzman, I think that you've done a wonderful job. We did hear this bill in Senator Metzen's committee, and this is something that we really need to do. So Senator Metzen moves that Senate file 292 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Saltzman.
Chair, and thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sharon, Senate file 1640. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Sparks. Good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm here to present Senate File 1640. This is a bill that seeks funding for an institute called IREDI. And what I'm going to do, because you've been here long and you've had a long meeting, and I'm going to have testifiers talk to you about what the institute is, what it's capable of doing, and why the state of Minnesota should have an interest in making certain that we make an appropriation so that this can happen in the state of Minnesota. What this bill does is direct money to go to IREDI, and IREDI is the International Renewable Energy Institute of Technology. Did I get that right? Close. Anyway, this is an institute that is going to be formed for a very important function for the state of Minnesota. And it is a recommendation that it be formed after a great deal of legwork has been done between the Biobusiness Partnership and the university in Mankato. Actually, DEED directed a grant process to the university in order to apply for the potential of bringing into the United States already developed technology for small and medium-sized businesses that use biomass to produce heat and energy. What this is one of many opportunities for technology that's already developed, that's already creating a positive outcome in terms of reducing our carbon footprint, and also creates the potential for new products to be manufactured in the United States from technology that's already developed in Europe and is already growing their domestic products substantially while reducing their carbon footprint. One such product will come from Sweden. It is a product that they want to bring here to the United States. And Minnesota State Mankato was selected in a grant process from many universities across the United States to be able to create this landing strip, so to speak, this place for products from Europe to come and land so that they can, already existing technology, be adapted to the United States standards, be adapted in a way that we can manufacture it here, sell it here, train people to take care of the product, to develop the product. And it has, from beginning to end, so many positive components to it. It's already existing technology. It reduces our carbon footprint. It creates potentials for growth in our economy. It creates opportunities for new job creation. All of the things that we are seeking to do in the state of Minnesota. And it makes Minnesota the place where these kinds of technologies will come and be adapted. So we become the receiving place for the global economy on these kinds of products. So that's what this is about. It's developing the institute. It already has a potential product to in which it can apply its expertise. But it becomes really an institute that will receive this kind of technology well beyond this initial product that's being proposed. That's the essence of it. And I have with me John Fry from Minnesota State University, Mankato. He's the Director of Business and Industry Partnership, Minnesota. Also Dale Wallstrom, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota. And Mike Davis, who's the President of the Swedish American Chamber of Commerce. And I've asked them to focus their remarks on those things that are pertinent to this committee.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Fry, and I would just like to speak a little bit to the fact that this is something that will benefit both Sweden and the United States and Minnesota, because Sweden will be able to expand their marketplace, whereas in Minnesota we will be able to increase our manufacturing and jobs in manufacturing, as well as jobs in areas of biomass production, harvesting, and processing. It also should be a point where we will spark our entrepreneurship in areas that will be very important to us in the future. We're going to be focusing primarily on combustible fuels, and that's a technology that is rather missing in the state and actually in the United States. And the point that I would like to make here is that that consumes about 40% of our energy right now in the U.S., so it's a very important part, and we would focus primarily on the residential as well as the small business. Now, in terms of businesses coming to the United States and to Minnesota, IREDI will provide the door, the entry point, and this will be the entry point primarily for small to medium-sized businesses. It's important that we get this center, because if we do not get it, it will move elsewhere. There's no question about that. I was in Sweden not too long ago, and I was talking to one member who was manufacturing burners for Germany. He had contracts, and he very much would like to come to Minnesota to expand his market here. However, he also realizes that there are other states that are bidding for it, and so it will not wait forever. This is something that I have a strong passion for, because it is something that I think will be beneficial to the entire state of Minnesota, and it will create a lasting economic development piece for Minnesota. So I will now turn it over to Dale Wahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Fry. Mr. Wahlstrom, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Dale Wahlstrom. I'm the CEO of the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota. For those of you who don't know us, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, industry-led. We're dedicated to the advancement of bioscience-related industries to create jobs in the state of Minnesota. And renewable energy, renewable materials industries are a focus area for us in our work. And we strongly support SF your file 1640. You have in your packet, I believe, an IREDA STT document to kind of shorten my testimony. I'm just going to move straight to that and work off of that document. IREDA STT is the higher level structure that has been put in place to support the development and transfer of technology into Minnesota and out of Minnesota. There are really three parts to that. If you look at the graph down below, my organization led the initial.
Do you have this, members?
If not, I have more copies. I have more copies here. If you don't, maybe you can distribute them. Anyway. I think they're in the pile, but if not, do you have it? Okay, thank you. The BioBusiness Alliance led the initial initiative to compete against 17 other states to establish the International Renewable Energy Technology Institute. Our proposal called for three separate components to be implemented. The first is IREDI, which is what we're talking about today. It's the academic piece. It's in that level in the organizational chart that has the three boxes in it. It is the one on the furthest left. It provides for applied technology and workforce development and supporting community implementation. The second part of it is the private sector support, the actual support to company transfer. That is being led right now by my organization underneath the umbrella called the International Business Support Center. And the third part is the International Bioenergy Days Congress, which is really an educational forum that Mankato State University hosted last fall for the first time in the United States. Coming from that Congress, which was held in September and the first part of October, was really the kickoff of the entire process, which took about almost a year from the time the RFP was submitted. The 17 states were that competed against it, and in which Minnesota was selected. The official kickoff was more or less in the September-October time frame. Since that time, to demonstrate the power of this system, we currently have seven Swedish companies that we are supporting. Those companies are being located in northeast Minnesota, western part of the state, the metro area, and also in the south. In addition to that, we have, and those evolution of those companies, or I should say the dialogue around those companies and the negotiations range from all the way up to site selection to the formation of partnerships with other companies. In all cases, they're headed towards partnerships with Minnesota companies. In addition to that, there's now an incremental 14 more that we have started dialogue with. Which one of those actually is a Minnesota company that is starting to look to go international to sell their product. So it is a system that works. We have requests from other countries. In fact, last week we hosted a company from Ireland, and when they left here on Friday night, their indication to us was to go back and make a recommendation to the board of directors that Minnesota is a place they want to settle. So in about 3 weeks, we'll be able to let you know if we landed that one or not. But the system works. And the one part that's missing right now that will cause the dominoes to fall in an unconstructive manner is if we don't get the academic piece installed, as was our commitment when we were granted the International Renewable Energy Technology Institute status here in Minnesota. With that, I'll turn it over to Mike Davis, who is the chairman of the Swedish Chamber of Commerce. And Swedish American Chamber of Commerce, sorry.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Davis.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Davis, and I'm the chairman of the Swedish American Chamber of Commerce, Minnesota. I'm also a board member of the national board for the Swedish American Chamber of Commerce. It's the second largest foreign American Chamber of Commerce in the nation, which is strange when one thinks that there are only 10 million people living in Sweden, but only the British American Chamber is larger than the Swedish American Chamber. Sweden, I will jump exactly to the pertinent things here. You have a packet which may be thick by some measures, but I will point you to a couple of key slides here. The first slide is this slide here, which shows a map with the different countries of Europe. And basically, this is the percentage of bioenergy generated in these different countries. And as you see, Finland and Sweden are right at the top with 28.6% for Sweden generated by bioenergy. The next slide is the one before that, which is shows that the Swedish gross national product has increased as the carbon emissions have gone down. So on the bottom, you see that the carbon emissions have gone down 9%, and you see that the gross national product has gone up 48% since 1990. And as you see here, the use of bioenergy has gone up 80% during that same time. So what we see is that when we bring the carbon emissions down, that our economy can still grow and grow healthily at that. If you might know, the Finland, Denmark, and Sweden are always ranked among the top five countries as far as the most competitive countries by the World Economic Forum. This year, I think they're third and fourth, respectively. Very competitive countries that are building on bioenergy. You also have a Business Week article that states 3,500 bioenergy companies located in Sweden with $14 billion in revenue. Again, this is a country that's barely double what Minnesota is. So Sweden is recognized as the global leader in this area. That's not to say that there aren't other countries that also have great technologies, but what we need here in order to bring not only that Swedish technology here, but from other countries, is we need IRREDI. And IRREDI can be the landing strip, because when they bring these technologies in, they need them to be standardized, and they need to take the European standards there and bring them in and standardize them to the American versions. And then also part of this is the training of workers. So Minnesota would be basically first up at bat to get these companies in here, to have other Minnesota companies develop them and bring them out into the U.S., distributing and manufacturing here in Minnesota. So basically we're being set up to bring in these companies. As Dale has expressed, he has seven companies right now that are ready to come here, but of course they have this need to be able to come in and have their products standardized and to be brought out in that way. Let's see. Then you will see this, which is a list of alternative energy opportunities in Sweden. This comes out of the U.S. Embassy in Sweden. Ambassador Michael Wood, he came to Sweden and he developed this list of companies that show 53 companies that he has gone around and vetted and found to have a technology that exceeds what is generally available here in the U.S. And so these companies are poised to come through the E-Ready pipeline and to have their products tested here. They're small and medium-sized companies that need these kind of services. And if you look at the different areas of technology there, they fit very well with Minnesota. It's the third page of that. And a couple of these, Minnesota has already lost a couple of opportunities here. Two of them have ended up in Michigan. One is a company called Chemrec. It is a company that has worldwide patents for turning black liquor, which is a residue from paper pulp, and being able to create DME, which is, it gets about 3 to 4 times the mileage per acre than ethanol does. And they came here, visited Minnesota, and they ended up landing in Michigan. Another one, Swedish Biogas, also did the same thing. And in Chemrec's case, that has the potential of creating 2% of the world's needs for gasoline based on paper pulp. So it's a big deal. And then you can see there's a press release from the U.S. Embassy in Sweden also, which names some of the success stories. There are 12 success stories there. Dale has mentioned seven that would like to be success stories here. And we will have actually the person who all of this comes from, Bengt-Erik Löfgren. He will be visiting the state next week. And Representative Jeremy Kalin and Senator Olsen will be hosting him in the state office building on the 14th from 9:30 to 10:30 in the morning in room 500N. And that information, I believe Senator Sharon can make sure that you all get, but that will be on the 14th. It will be a chance to test him and find out about these things and how this all came together. But the International Bioenergy Days comes out of him. E-Ready comes out of him. AFAB comes out of him. All of these things come out of his visits to here with the Swedish American Chamber. With that, I'll thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Okay. All right. Any further discussion, committee? If not, Senator Saxog moves that Senate File 1640 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator
Sheeran.
Thank you
very much. Time.
We have one bill remaining on our list today, Senator Bach. Senate File 1661.
Chairman, I'm getting to like my iPhone. I was just reading an email from a constituent of whose? Let's see. Who is he from? Lionel Lakes. Who has Lionel Lakes?
Olsen, maybe?
Senator Olsen?
Senator Vandiver, I think.
Or it would be Senator Schott.
Said that he's writing to me because he's heard that I'm one of the more level-headed people in the legislature.
Whoa.
Isn't that nice? I have to send him a
thank you. Can't he see by looking at him his head isn't level?
It's not. Who has like Lionel Lakes?
Flat.
Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, Senator Bach, maybe that's because you got a level on your iPhone.
Mr. Chairman, that person's name must end in L-A or E-N-N or something like that.
Have a confession. He's a former ranger. He's living in Lionel Lakes under duress, and he thinks the property taxes are way too high compared to the property taxes in Hoyt Lakes, Senator Tomasoni. His parents and his brother live in Hoyt Lakes, and his property tax in Lionel Lakes are much higher, and he's trying
surprise
to find out why.
The house is probably worth more.
I sent him that response, and he replied back. At least in the reply back, he called me level-headed. Mr. Chairman,
Senator
Senate File 1661 addresses really an issue that we've been trying to get our arms around for a number of years. It was in this room, in the Conference Committee on the Environment, Economic Development, Finance Bill in 2005. And I carried that bill for Senator Sams. That was the session that Senator Sams was sick and doctoring in Rochester. And one of the provisions in that bill that year was a provision that required the licensing of independent contractors. And it's an issue that's been brought to us by people that work in the construction trades. There is apparently a growing use of independent contractors, and most people feel it's a result of what were otherwise legitimate employers to get out from under the costs of payroll overhead. So they start to misclassify their employees as independent contractors and avoid workers' compensation, unemployment, FICA, employer share of FICA. And so I've come to believe that that's true, that that is going on out there. So in 2005, we made our first effort here in this room to get our arms around the misclassification of people as independent contractors. We passed another provision in 2008, I believe, that required actually a license, independent contractor license, and in the tax bill, a withholding provision that said if you hire an independent, somebody a 1099 employee, you have to withhold 2%, send it into the Department of Revenue. The thought there was, let's try to find out who all these independent contractors are, so the Department of Revenue then could do some random audits on that group of taxpayers and see if we're getting the correct portion of taxes from their line of business. It was well intended, but what we found out, and some people actually late in the session last year cautioned us that this could happen. What people did is rather than register as an independent contractor and go through all of the hoops required to do that, they went in droves over to the Secretary of State's office and incorporated themselves as limited liability corporations, LLCs, and were able to get around the new independent contractor licensure requirement over at Labor and Industry by going to the Secretary of State's office and registering as an LLC. So we still haven't figured out how to get our arms around this piece of the economy, and we suspect, in the tax committee, we suspect there's an awful lot of underreported income going on there. So what we bring to you this year is a different approach to try and find out who all these individuals are. This approach this year is to require them to register over at the Department of Labor and Industry. Doesn't require a license, just that they go over to Labor and Industry, fill out a form to register themselves. And you can see on the bill a list of the kind of information that they have to give about their business. Just to try and see if we can start to get our arms around who all these people are that are doing this work. And it's interesting when you look at, I don't think this has been handed out to everybody, but this, oh, do we have it?
We do have it, Senator.
This is from the Finance and Commerce. These are the recent March 12th. These are the listings of the new people that registered over as LLCs over at Secretary of State's office. What we don't know about them is how many. You can see by the names, many of them are construction-related. It's a tremendous spike. The quarter from December 08 to February 09, these registrations are up 97% from the same quarter a year ago. So there's clearly something going on. Might be as simple as it's just easier to go over and register as an LLC. Many of these people on this that are circled in red here are very legitimate businesses that are forming LLCs for one reason or another, but we think a whole lot of them are likely people that just want to avoid the requirements of the independent contractor law, so they decided to go the LLC route instead. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes what I had to say on this issue. Mr. Macarios is here from the Carpenters Union. The Carpenters have spent a lot of time and energy on this issue. And, you know, if we could get our arms around some of this cash economy that's going on, a lot of us would pay less in taxes if everybody paid their fair share. And I, you know, some of my strongest supporters in my fundraising efforts to stay in the legislature have been from contractors who appreciate the fact that we have members in the legislature that understand their industry. And I've got some good, good friends that are employers, and they run payroll, and they pay workers' comp and unemployment comp, pensions and health insurance to their employees. And it's getting more and more difficult for them to compete out in the marketplace with competitors who don't have any of those kind of payroll overheads. So I think we need to make as good an effort as we can to try and make sure that it's a level playing field for our employers out there, that the ones that get the work are those that are the most productive, not those that are able to find a way to avoid paying payroll overhead to their employees to gain some competitive advantage over their competitors who are paying those kind of costs. And Ms. Frenette is here from the Builders Association. Both of them are available to answer any questions the committee might have.
Wonderful. Thank you, Senator Bott. Any further discussion? Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Tomassoni would move that Senate File 1661 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bott.
Ms. Frenette would like to get on the record.
Okay.
She's getting paid to be here, so we should give her a chance to...
All right, Mr. Chair, members, Lisa Frenette with the Builders Association of Minnesota. I'd be remiss if I sat up here and didn't get a chance to speak. I've been to speak all day long in several committees, so I'm lucky to have this advantage. The Builders Association of Minnesota does support this legislation, with the caveat, however, that we've been working with the Carpenters and Senator Bach and Representative Mike Nelson on the independent contractor rules that Senator Bach earlier said really are not working right now. We're looking at how we can fix those and dovetail the two programs together in some respect.
Thank you, Ms. Burnett.
Chairman, that's accurate testimony on her part.
Senator Tomassoni.
And Senator Bach, do you want this to stay here or do you want this to move by itself?
Chairman, I'm not sure what the status is in the House, so I think it might be safer for it to move in your committee bill, and I think it certainly fits there.
So then Senator Tomassoni would renew his motion that Senate File 1661 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Economic Development and Housing Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Bott.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Mr. O'Rourke.
Mr. Chair and members, we are on break until next Wednesday. In the meantime, Senator Tomassoni, along with fiscal staff and council, is trying to put together a draft spreadsheet for the omnibus, and also we have a few language from some bills that we've heard this session, and so we are going to try to release those to the public as soon as they are ready, and then we will ideally take those up next Wednesday for passage out of the division. So
anything else, David?
Nope.
With that, thank you, committee members. Meeting is adjourned.
This bill went. This is the one you have talked about. The one that you